This podcast of NPR's On Point with Tom Ashbrook is a production of WBUR Boston.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point, pop quiz time. For 20 points and a hall pass for a week, how did the first humans come to America? If you say across a land bridge from Siberia, you get an A for remembering what generations of kids have been taught. If you add on foot through Alaska and down through a gap in Canadian ice sheets, you get extra credit for recall. But now it's time for us all to go back to class. New archaeology is adding big new ideas to the first Americans' truly amazing story. Maybe they weren't inland striders. Maybe they were beach boys. Maybe they came in boats out of the mists of deeper time than we ever imagined. Up next on Point to the land of the woolly mammoth with the first Americans. Joining me now from New York is Andrea Dorfman. She's lead reporter for the science section at Time magazine and co-author of this week's cover story, The Untold Saga of Early Man in America. Andrea, thanks for being with us.
Thank you, Tom.
So a lot of the excitement is hinging around this skeleton that's emerged in the West, Kennewick Man. What's the story of this very new but very old skeleton?
Well, Kennewick Man is actually a skeleton that was found about in 1996 mm-hmm. by two students wandering along the Columbia River near Kennewick, Washington. And what's put it in the news again is that it was the subject of a lawsuit for almost 9 years with a group of scientists who desperately wanted to study it because it's more than 9,000 years old, which is quite rare, at least in the Americas. Pitted against the U.S. government, which technically owns the bones, and a number of Native American tribes in the Columbia Basin who claim the skeleton as their ancestor.
And they finally got 10 days to come in, look at this skeleton. It's amazingly complete. I mean, perhaps not in every bone, but it's a full, very clear skeleton. This is no fragment. 9,300 years old, we're told. And what are archaeologists, scientists learning from Kennewick Man?
Well, you know, it's actually pretty amazing what you can learn from a skeleton in just 10 days, and that the scientists were able to take the pieces of the skull, it's now in about 11 pieces, and take them and have them CAT scanned and then copy them and reassemble the skull so they could see what it looked like. They've looked at the teeth, which are very worn down and which indicate that Kennewick Man probably ate something with a lot of grit in his diet. They're studying the bones to see whether they can tell if he was a vegetarian or whether he liked meat or maybe he liked fish, which you can tell by looking at levels of carbon and nitrogen in the bones. He has an injury, a stone spear point that's embedded in his hip that the archaeologists can tell. It wasn't fatal because the bone grew back around the spear point, but they can tell that he was attacked from the front from quite a distance. They looked at his knees, and they can tell that he probably had arthritis, but not enough to be crippling. They can look at the bones themselves to tell that he had actually been intentionally buried, which was perhaps the most surprising finding, by lining up the bones in certain mineral deposits that form when water evaporates. They could tell that he was lying on his back with his arms at his side and his legs and feet stretched out.
Not just falling down, dying where he lay, but with some attention paid to that there. You've got a recreation on the cover of the magazine, I guess trying to bring this in life. It looks a little bit, I don't know, like Jermaine Jackson meets Pocahontas.
I don't think that was our intention, but okay.
how does this figure in to the changing understanding of where the first Americans came from and how they got to the Americas? What are the theories that are out there contending now or growing?
Well, there's been a long-standing theory that, based on a number of sites that were found in the United States, that all had very similar spear points, that the first Americans walked across this land bridge that you mentioned in your introduction from Siberia over to Alaska, and then maybe about 12,000 years ago, and then gradually made their way down the middle of the continent, sort of just east of the Rocky Mountains.
That is through an opening in the ice sheets that covered so much of the continent then, yes.
That's right. But in the past 20 years or so, people have started to find sites in as far south as southern Chile that seem to be older than 12,000 years. And if that's the case, well, clearly humans didn't somehow sprint thousands of miles from Alaska to southern Chile in that time period. So how did they make it that far south? Well, if it were before 12,000 years, there was no convenient ice-free path down the Americas. It was covered with ice. Mm. So they would have to have come another way. And the newest theories suggest that they somehow made their way down the Pacific coast. One researcher actually suggested that there was sort of what he calls a kelp highway, that there are...
Kelp, as in K-E-L-P, the plant in the water.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Mm-hmm. And this would have been not only a food source in and of itself, but would have been something that attracted mollusks and seals and other things that would have also provided food. And so it would have been very easy for peoples wandering down this coast, which at that point was ice-free, to be able to feed themselves. It would not have been impossible.
Wandering down the coast or bobbing down the coast in some kind of watercraft boat?
Well, nobody really knows because scientists have never found any signs of prehistoric boats. But there are some sites that have cropped up on the Channel Islands just off the coast of California that are old enough to fit into this time period, and they were not connected to the coast at the time, so it's assumed that perhaps people got there by boat.
And then there are the notions being put forward that maybe it wasn't, it was from the southern Pacific, or maybe even the northern Atlantic.
That's right. Well, there are some studies that of the shape and sort of different traits of skulls from ancient North American and South American populations that suggest that South Americans of this age period, say 8,000 years and older, might have actually come from the South Pacific. And then the question becomes, you know, did they somehow take the long road up the Pacific Rim and then all the way around Alaska and
through Siberia,
South America?
Yep. Mm-hmm.
Or did they take the short route and sail across the Pacific? And we know that people somehow made it to Australia about 60,000 years ago, presumably by boat in some form. And Thor Heyerdahl's Kon-Tiki expedition showed that you could sail in the opposite direction on a balsa raft. So it's not totally out of the question.
Then you've got new findings in South Carolina and even the idea that maybe there's some connection to Europe and hunters that came across the North Atlantic disputed that one, but some strong feelings about it.
That's right. And, you know, whether or not that's actually true, that the time periods don't quite fit, but there are a group of scientists who see a lot of similarities between particularly the stone spears spear points that were formed in France and Spain, and then at this site called Topper in South Carolina. And they see enough similarity to suggest that maybe one derived from the European civilization.
Andrea Dorfman, you paint a great picture of how the map of our understanding is changing, and we thank you for doing it. Thanks a lot for being with us.
Well, thank you, Tom.
Andrea Dorfman, senior reporter for the science section at Time Magazine. We're talking this hour about the first Americans. Joining me now from Dallas, Texas, is David Meltzer. He's professor of anthropology at Southern Methodist University. He's also author of Search for the First Americans. Dr. Meltzer, thanks for being with us.
Hello, Tom.
So give us your anthropologist, archaeologist view of how our understanding is changing here. Was it not down through a gap in the ice? Was it along the coast? Could it have been both?
Well, Tom, actually, the neat thing is that the more we learn, and perhaps this is not surprising, the more complex the situation gets. Mm. In fact, we may well be talking about multiple migrations, one of which came down the coast relatively early, another which came down through that interior ice-free corridor, as we call it, into the Americas, because one of the things that we're noticing is that the archaeological records of this time period are not always concordant. That is to say, we get some very, very different material from some of these early sites than we do from the traditional notion of the first Americans, those Clovis groups, as they're called. Mm-hmm. And so the differences there, granting that we don't have a very good sample, but the differences are certainly suggestive of the possibility that North America was actually peopled on multiple occasions.
Over some thousands of years, and that even that span now subject to some debate. I mean, we've talked a lot about 9,000 years, but you've got some people now reaching much further back in time. What are the implications of that?
Well, absolutely. And I think perhaps the first thing to keep in mind is that there really were no significant barriers from getting from Siberia to Alaska. That is to say, the Bering Land Bridge was essentially a highway across which animals and certainly humans trafficked for thousands of years.
And it wasn't skinny. This is a very, very broad swath of land as depicted here.
That's exactly right. Don't think about crossing a rope bridge over some Amazon river somewhere. This is about 1,000 to 1,500 kilometers wide. Folks going from Siberia to Alaska wouldn't even necessarily have realized they were crossing continents into a new world. And so coming into that area then, you then had to sort of figure out, okay, where do you go next? And do you go south? And how do you go south? The interior route, as we now know, probably closed down relatively early.
That is this corridor that opened up through the ice sheet there.
Correctly. Mm-hmm. Correct. And it probably closed down as much as 30,000 years ago and did not open up until around 13,000 years ago. But when it initially opened, it was still impassable because as the ice sheets pulled apart and that route opened to the south, they left behind vast meltwater lakes. It was cold. It was nasty. Nothing was growing there. Once it became habitable, which we suspect was right around 12,000, then people could pass through. But, of course, we now know that there's evidence in southern South America that people were there at 12,500 years ago.
David Meltzer, I wish you'd do us a favor and paint a picture of, to the extent that you can, and I know we're talking about a span of some thousands of years here, but paint a picture of the flora and fauna, megafauna, as they're sometimes called, and the terrain. I mean, this is all about ice caps and coastlines changing. That's on people's minds these days. By way of contrast, what did these Americas look like when they first came into the sites, however unintentional, of the first Americans?
The landscape would have been completely different to us. To them, not necessarily, because, of course, they're coming from Siberia. They're coming from an Arctic environment, and they're moving south through a glacial environment that they're familiar with. What becomes more of a challenge for them is once they get south of the vast ice sheets that covered essentially much of Canada today.
So we're talking all the way down to the Great Lakes, really, right? Almost down to across the U.S. border.
Exactly right. In fact, the Great Lakes were just forming because the Great Lakes are literally just meltwater puddles from the retreat of the ice sheet. Mm-hmm. And as they got further and further south, they would have come onto a landscape that was increasingly unfamiliar. Imagine, if you will, coming into a landscape where, say, you've never encountered a skunk or a rattlesnake.
Those would both get your attention, yeah.
Well, exactly right, but you wouldn't necessarily know how to deal with them. Mm-hmm. It's also a landscape that was teeming with large game. We now know that there are some 36 genera of mammals, ranging from mammoths, horses, camels, very large bison, ground sloths, which were dotting the landscape.
And what kind of scale compared to the way we think of bison now?
Oh, probably the bison that were around then were about 1.5, perhaps slightly larger than modern bison today. The mammoths are upwards of 3 to 4 tons.
Ground is that sloths. Elephant scale with fur? Is that, do we have the picture right?
Exactly right. Mm-hmm. And you've got sloths, which today, you know, the largest ones you'll get in South America are 20 pounds. These things stood about the size of a giraffe and probably weighed about 5 tons.
Were they
lumbering across the landscape?
How would they have interacted with Homo sapien, with active, intelligent hunters?
Well, in fact, one of the long-standing arguments has been is that humans did, in fact, prey on these critters and that, in fact, humans were responsible for their extinction.
Because they wouldn't have been fearful of man?
Well, that's the argument, is that these animals had essentially lived in evolutionary isolation from any kind of human predation ever. And so when humans came onto the landscape, they were naive. Now, that works the first time you stick a spear into a mammoth. Mm. The second time, it remembers. And as folks who work in Africa among African elephant hunters will tell you, elephants don't behave like animals. They behave like enemies, and they have long memories.
Mm-hmm. And that can happen pretty quick. Now, the topography matters here in part because this theory of the water or coastline approach down the Pacific coast presumes what Andrea called the kelp highway, a wider coastline and a coastline teeming with vegetation and life that would have fed and maybe protected people, what, on the beach or in boats?
Well, we don't know whether the beach or in boats. We certainly do know, though, that the coastline of the Americas was much further out than it is at present, simply because you had lowered global sea levels as a consequence of all that ice being piled up on land. Mm-hmm. And groups coming down the coast were walking down seashores that are simply now underwater. So we don't really have a clear sense of what it looked like. We do know that boat travel in the North Pacific really doesn't seem to kick in until around 6,000 or so years ago. So the suggestions that they were coming down the coast, say, around 12,000 years ago by boat are difficult to – certainly we have no evidence for it, and we don't necessarily have strong reason to suspect that's the case either.
So you're thinking that if there was a coastal advance, it would have been on foot scrabbling along there?
That's my sense at the moment. And unfortunately, the sites are either underwater, though there are portions of southeast Alaska today where, because of tectonic activity, the sea coast has essentially been uplifted. And so you can actually walk along Ice Age seashore. It's about 100 meters above present-day sea level.
But it is interesting. We've got new information, and out of that, new theories. And I'm sure we'll hear some from another archaeologist in a moment. But there are some real debates going on about what this might have looked like. Listeners, you can join us, 800-423-TALK. Steve is calling from Columbia, South Carolina. Hi, Steve. You're on the air.
Hi. Fine, thanks. How are you all doing?
We're well. What do you think, Steve? What do you know?
I just finished not that long ago the book Guns, Germs, and Steel, talking about the migration, you know, worldwide of humans.
Yeah, Jared Diamond's book. Yeah,
right. And I'm completely fascinated by this because it all kind of made sense with the whole east-west orientation and how culture spread that way. But I was wondering if any of these new findings make any major changes to what was brought up in that book.
I don't know the premise exactly of the book there when it comes to this, but David Meltzer, what about new findings and how they're changing premises, Jared Diamond's or others? Right there in South Carolina, we've got Al Goodyear saying he's got remains that go way back earlier than we thought, a whole new picture emerging. How are new findings changing the picture?
Well, let me see if I can actually address the Jared Diamond issue there for just a moment, and that is to say that Jared was making an argument about the movement of people into Europe. One of the things that's striking about the American situation is that there wasn't necessarily a strong incentive that we can see for getting people to come into the New World in Ice Age times. In other words, populations weren't expanding at great numbers. They weren't being forced to find new land, but they do expand into the Americas. And they expand into the Americas, we now know, at a much earlier time than we thought. The evidence that's coming out of the Topper site in South Carolina suggests it's a whole lot earlier than even we were speculating a few years ago. That evidence is certainly intriguing, but it has not been fully published and fully agreed upon by the archaeological communities, so, among whom are a number of skeptics.
You've still got maybe a too early to know exactly here, to the extent we can ever fully know. Clovis is the word that came up earlier because of the Clovis, New Mexico site where certain kinds of chipstone tools were found around a lot of the Americas. But now part of the evidence, I guess, here is you've got tools that simply look different. They don't look part of the same family or the same period. Is that right?
That's exactly right. The topper material really doesn't look like Clovis at all. And it's important to keep in mind, too, that we are talking about, with these earliest populations, a relatively small number of people spread across a vast area and spread across maybe several thousand years. So we've got groups that are living perhaps in relative isolation from one another for long periods of time. As a result, we will probably expect to see a fair amount of variety in the kinds of tools that they make and the kinds of artifacts that they use, simply by virtue of the fact that they're not all staying connected. They're not all exchanging information and exchanging tool types and that kind of thing. So the mere fact that we haven't got a clear pattern emerging isn't necessarily surprising at the moment, simply because we're trying to track a fairly elusive population. And there's not a lot of sites that they left behind for us.
But clearly they came and stayed at some point, which means they were having families here and all the rest. How do you picture, do we know, does the Kennewick Man help us understand how they traveled? What kind of community or even society, if that's not too great a word, was this? I mean, clearly there were men and women here to make this thing work over time.
Absolutely. You know, the old term that we've always used was early man, but early man doesn't get very far without early woman.
Not too many thousand years, that's for sure.
Yeah, exactly. With Kennewick and some of the other skeletal material, one of the things that's really interesting that's emerging here is that we are perhaps getting a glimpse of population history. We are getting a glimpse in the variety of skeletal forms that we see that, in fact, groups probably were isolated for long periods of time. We have genetic drift taking place. And
genetic drift meaning?
And essentially, when you've got no gene flow among all sorts of different groups, they develop sort of unique characters to that particular group. And then when populations build up to a certain point and there's more gene flow between them, that is to say mating between mm-hmm. them, you get a different look.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And there it is. So families, some kind of communities, but as you say, elusive, maybe very small units there, well, almost certainly at first. Lisa's calling from Watertown, Massachusetts. Hi, Lisa, you're on the air.
Hi. I have looked at photographs of Native Americans by Edward Curtis, and when we talk about the racial ethnic mix of people earlier to these times, I think it's kind of interesting to look at the faces of these photographs and see that they're not just Asian characteristics, facial features. Excuse me, I just got off my treadmill. I think they're also Anglo, and I wondered, in terms of earlier photographs of Native Americans, if there's a consciousness about just facial features alone and being such a mix of possible cultures in earlier times.
So you look there at what we build up off the skulls and you see Anglo features. David Meltzer, how about it? Are we learning? Could there be very different sources of origin here?
Well, in theory, it's possible. Certainly the photographs that one sees from the 19th century may include some admixture between Europeans and Native American groups, so that the forms that you're seeing in the photographs may not necessarily represent the Native Americans as they looked at contact in 1492. As to whether groups could have come across from other areas, that is to say Europe, one of the things that's really striking about the genetic evidence, certainly the dental evidence, even the linguistic evidence, if you will, has indicated that there's really no strong biological component of Europeans in and amongst any Native American groups. It really looks like all the signs are pointing to Northeast Asia.
And yet, we've got theories coming from different angles as well. David Meltzer, stand by for a moment. I want to welcome into our conversation from Washington, Dennis Stanford. He's curator of archaeology at the National Museum of Natural History at the Smithsonian Institution. He's argued for the Salutrian theory of people coming from what is now France and Spain across the North Atlantic to the east coast of North and South America. Dennis Stanford, thanks very much for being with us.
Hi, Tom and Dave. How are you today?
Hi, Dennis.
And we know there's a hot debate here, but paint the picture for us, Dennis Stanford. What have you found? What do you think it suggests?
Well, when I was a graduate student, we were well immersed in the Clovis First hypothesis, and I went off to Alaska to find the origin of Clovis, or the first Clovis we could find in Alaska. And after 30 years of research, it became pretty clear to me and others that the Clovis technology that we recognize from New Mexico was not related to much, if anything, in Alaska. But we always thought if we got into Siberia, we would find the answers. And sure enough, when we got to Siberia in the early 1990s, and we were able to examine the collections and sites, we found very little evidence of an ancestral technology for Clovis.
So now you've looked to France and Spain and perhaps a pathway around the North Atlantic of hunters following walrus and seal that would have ended up in the Americas.
That's correct, Tom. What we did then was look around to see what sorts of technologies there may be that could give rise to Clovis, because the Clovis technology is pretty unique and it spread from coast to coast, and that's why we thought it was the basal occupation. But what we found in the Iberian Peninsula in particular is that there is technology there known as Salutrian that has an awful lot of the components we see in Clovis.
And when you say technology, you mean the manner of chipping stone tools, I guess.
Well, the manner of chipping stone tools, the manner of manufacturing osseous tools such as out of ivory, bone, antler, the like, as well as other features of their culture which are very similar to things we see in Clovis. So Bruce Bradley, my colleague, and I formulated a hypothesis that we think that this is something we ought to seriously test. And so we have begun to do that.
Now, we know that it's the job of scientists like yourselves to go hard at these things. David Meltzer, you've called it an outrageous hypothesis. We'll keep this all at the nice professional level here, but why do you think it's outrageous, the notion that there might have been this traffic around the North Atlantic?
Well, I think it's outrageous in a good way. One of the things that we've learned over the years is that we should never completely rule out a priori and without any kind of consideration ideas that seem to us improbable, impossible, or just plain crazy. And the best example of that is that for 40 years, geologists didn't for a moment believe that the continents moved around. Mm-hmm. And they didn't for a moment believe that crazy idea by a fellow by the name of Alfred Wegener until, indeed, in the late 1950s and early 1960s, they discovered, in fact, that the continents had moved around. Mm-hmm. So outrageous hypotheses on their own are not bad. What we have to do now, and this is certainly something that Dennis and Bruce have been working on, and this is something that I've been looking at with a couple of my colleagues as well, is to say, okay, if in fact that notion is true, what would we expect to see in the archaeological record, and do we in fact see that in the archaeological record? And our sense is we're skeptical. Certainly given the current evidence that we see in the archaeological record, it doesn't work for us, and it doesn't work for us on several levels, which we can get into the details and the minutiae of stone tool technology if you'd like, but maybe to keep it at a broader level, we see general problems with the chronology, matching up Solutrean, which ends at about 16,500 years ago, with Clovis, which only begins around 11,500 years ago. We don't see a lot of the distinctive features of Solutrean in the Americas that we would expect to see. Keep in mind that if groups are coming across the North Atlantic and they're beaching themselves on the East Coast, they should in fact have made this trip in a relatively short period of time and come with a full complement of Solutrean culture. And yet we don't really see that full complement of Solutrean culture in the Americas.
Dennis so Stanford, you're putting it out there. Do you think that it may sound outrageous today? Do you think in a century we're going to look back and say, wow, it was Europeans on the East Coast after all?
Well, I obviously have a different opinion than Dave, but we do see quite a bit of a specific complement of Solutrean culture. And when you look at the Solutrean writ large in Europe, you can see that it's divided into several different kinds. And we have sort of pinpointed the Cantabrian area in south western France as the source area.
Kingsley's calling from Needham, Massachusetts. Hi, Kingsley. You're on the air.
Good morning, and thank you. My question is, what was the human population of the Earth 10,000 years ago, and what kind of fossil fuels were they burning, and what contribution did that make to the warming of the globe at that time?
Kingsley, are you assuming from that it wasn't just wood, that it was coal or something else?
Well, no, I think that my point is that we are supposed to believe today that global warming is caused by the human use of fossil fuels, which put CO2 into the atmosphere.
Yeah.
Now, 10,000 years ago, as somebody pointed out earlier, much of North America was covered with a great sheet of ice, some of which was as much as 10,000 feet thick. Now, the Earth warmed, and the ice melted, the glaciers moved north. Why?
You're suggesting it had not much to do with campfires. Let us pick it up. Dennis Stanford, to you, the population, the human population of the planet 10,000 years ago. Do we have any idea?
Well, not specifically, but in North America, at least, it was probably pretty low. In the Near East and maybe Southeast Asia, the population was pretty high.
What does high mean 10,000 years ago?
I have
as big
no
as
idea.
Cleveland? I mean, globally? David Meltzer, do we have any notion whatsoever of how many Homo sapiens were on the planet?
No, but I like the Cleveland unit of measure. That's a new one that we'll have to introduce into the literature.
Six Clevelands by 5,000 BP.
Exactly. But actually, let me address Kingsley's question, because I think it's a useful one, and it can be used to clarify some things. The onset and the decline of vast glaciers is a consequence of a bunch of things, but primarily orbital changes in the Earth, which change the relationship and the distance and the angle of the Earth relative to the sun, which, of course, changes the amount of solar radiation received on the surface of the planet. When you change all that, you can grow glaciers or you can take them away. In terms of global warming, so all of that is happening independent of global warming. What we do see and what recent evidence has suggested is that probably around 7,000 or 6,000 years ago when humans became farmers and started clearing forests in large areas, we actually do start to see the first signal of an anthropogenic warming effect, because they're burning trees, they're covering or they're removing the cover of vast areas of the landscape. That notion is somewhat controversial in the paleoecological community, but it's certainly been put forth. But nothing that was done in prehistory is anything like the scale of the rapid increase in carbon dioxide atmospheric rates that we've seen in the last couple hundred years, certainly in the last 30.
At the climate level, Dennis Tanford, what about the level of fauna, let's say? Do you have a sense of how many years it was, hundreds, thousands before human population changed the rest of the animal life in the Americas?
Well, I think they started pretty early. Elephants, for instance, as mammoths and mastodons are, have a long gestation period, and they have very few offsprings. And if one is controlling water sources, such as we know the Clovis people did, they would dig wells, and then the elephants and mammoths would be attracted to those spots, and then they could nail them, and it wouldn't take long before you could seriously impact the reproduction rates and the growth of the herds. In fact, I think there's a real good possibility that the death nail, at least for many of these animals, were caused by humans.
So bad news quick for the woolly mammoth. Larry's calling from Spokane, Washington. Hi, Larry. You're on the air.
Yes. I've spent the last about 6 years studying the area of confluence of the Yellowstone and Missouri rivers. And
I'm sorry, which two? The Missouri and the?
Yellowstone and the Missouri.
Yellowstone, all right, yes.
And the recent DNA research on the dogs that the early hunters brought with them as early as 12,000 years ago shows that they were descended from five female wolves in East Asia, probably China, where their domestication began at least 100,000 years ago.
What does that tell you, Larry?
Well, that tells me that you know, we have the European thing might be a separate incident, you know, of migration, but we certainly have a record of people coming from Asia
And bringing their dogs right along with them. David Meltzer, what about that? Do you know anything about the canine history, about the things they carried? And I've seen also some emerging new thinking on exactly where in Asia these first Americans came from.
Well, in fact, there's been a lot of genetic evidence of late coming out which suggests that human groups originated in the Altai region of Mongolia. And while that is striking evidence, we should not put too much weight on it, and here's why. The way these molecular clocks work is that they look for similarities in genetic signatures in mitochondrial DNA and on the Y chromosome between modern groups. We have in the Altai region of Mongolia groups that have a genetic signature very, very similar to those of Native Americans. That doesn't necessarily mean that Native Americans came from that spot, because we don't necessarily want to assume that the folks who are living in the Altai today have been living there for the last 20,000 years. I mean, we know these populations move because, of course, some of them came to the New World. So this happens to be where groups that are most similar to Native Americans live today. It doesn't necessarily mean that's where they came from.
What about, I've heard the Ainu mentioned recently, the Japanese ethnic group, Dennis Tanford. Do you see changes in our understanding of more immediately where people came from, whether or not they were the first ones in the region?
Well, when we look at the physical features of Kennewick man and others that have been found on the west coast of the Americas, they the biometrics of the skull, they look very much like Ainu or Paleo-Ainu, the Jomon people of Japan. And these people we know were maritime, big time. They were out on the ocean in Japan. And these early skeletons in North America look very much like these people.
Walker's calling from Berlin, Massachusetts. Hi, Walker. You're on the air.
Hi. I've had a pet theory for many years with absolutely no scholarship behind it, but the previous comment provided me a great segue. The vector I like to look at is linguistic, and specifically place names. There are many of the Native American place names in the North America are highly polysyllabic, as in Massachusetts and Mississippi and Connecticut.
Okay.
And I observe that Japanese names are highly polysyllabic, whereas Chinese names are usually one or two syllables.
So you're comparing Shanghai and Yokohama, and what do you learn?
Linguistic prejudice towards the Japanese, having done a lot of the colonization.
Yeah, David Meltzer, you can hear people trying to peer back here on the, what vectors they can pick up on. Is it possible to do linguistic archaeology, if there can be such a thing? I mean, does it take us back? Does it tell us something at this stretch in time?
Well, actually, there has been a fair amount of linguistic work which is probing into this issue of who the first Americans are or who Native Americans are and who they might be related to. But as far as I understand it, most of the linguistic evidence that indicates a connection between the New World and the Old World is actually among the Eskimo Aleut languages. It's a language family that extends from Alaska essentially over to Greenland. And you have similarities between some of the Eskimo Aleut languages and languages that are spoken in Kamchatka and Chukchi and that sort of thing. Languages spoken in eastern North America, say in Massachusetts, really don't show any similarities at all, at least to professional linguists, and I'm not one, to any kind of languages in the Old World, let alone China or Japan.
Aaron's calling from Wilton, New Hampshire. Hi, Aaron. You're on the air.
Hello. It's great to be on the show.
Good to have you.
I've been a professional sailor for the last 10 years or so,
yep.
And I'm interested in knowing what research has been done on what the prevailing currents and winds would have been that would have brought folks over or people over from Europe to the Carolinas, or what the currents would have been down from Alaska through California.
Great question. Dennis Stanford, this sounds like your bailiwick. Can we look back and understand and know what currents and winds were 10,000 years ago?
Yes, we can. We can look at the debris that comes out of glaciers that as they melt on the currents, and that debris settles to the bottom of the ocean, and then through the ocean cores, where we're drilling, scientists are drilling cores into the ocean floor and analyzing the materials that come out of that, they can get a good idea of where the icebergs were floating from. This is called ice raft debris. And by plotting all of that onto maps, you can get a pretty good idea of where the paleo currents were.
So how did they look then? If you look at the Atlantic, North Atlantic in that time, the Pacific, do they look favorable toward bringing humans here?
Well, they're pretty much the same as they are now, only a lot of it was pushed further south because of the ice edge. And your Gulf Stream or Gulf Current would have gone into the Bay of Biscay and then split and come on up to further north. And people working along that ice edge, the current isn't quite right, but the wind is better, because what you have is the wind coming off of the ice onto the warmer water. And so you're getting the downdrafts. And if you know, if you're sailing and an experienced sailor, you would know that that would be a good way to move your craft.
So is your picture of hunters coming from Europe chasing their seal and walrus and ox, is it dependent on current and wind, or would they have been hugging the coastline and just following that next walrus until suddenly they were in Newfoundland?
Well, they definitely, I think, were hugging the ice coastline. Because when you get out on the deep water, for instance, that's when the waves that caused the major problems for small craft, they're pretty well ameliorated by the ice. And when big storms come up, you can move into ice leads and the like and kind of set them out.
Mm.
And it's also along that ice edge where you're hunting your seals and ox and various animals. And so it's basically very similar to the land bridge. You can get off of the water anytime you want. And in many times, I think, when they're using skin boats, they have to get off of the water and let the boats dry out for a while.
Robert's calling from Altamont, Kansas. Hi, Robert. You're on the air.
Hi, how are you doing?
Very well.
I'm just very curious as to the oldest archaeological site that would be uniformly accepted in North or South America. Now, several years ago, you would read where there were lots of dates in South America that were in the 20s and even 30,000 years BP, mm-hmm. and I would be curious to know whether those are dates that are uniformly accepted in North America.
BP, as in before the present, a nice, clean measure that archaeologists use. David Meltzer, what about it? How old the oldest sites that are universally accepted or commonly accepted?
I think it's fair to say that the oldest site that we, by consensus, agree on is a place called Monteverde in southern Chile that dates to 12,500, excavated by our colleague Tom Dillahay, now at Vanderbilt University. The Monteverde site is the oldest. There are older ones in South America that have been claimed, but none of them so far has sort of met muster with a still skeptical archaeological community.
And most of what we've talked about today, though, is people coming from the land bridge or the Bering Straits, or Dennis Stanford would say the North Atlantic. That's a long way from Chile. How do you get the oldest site there?
Well, that's the interesting thing, is that if they're in southern Chile at 12,500, they must have come through North America a whole lot earlier. And so we actually expect to find still older sites in North America, which is why sites like Topper are intriguing to us, because they really ought to be there, because you don't get to Monteverde in a flash. You can't get from Siberia down to Monteverde in the space of a couple of years. It probably took time, maybe perhaps even thousands of years.
David Meltzer, Dennis Stanford, I'm struck at how archaeologists have to look at bits of stone and bone and project a whole picture back so far. I'm not sure how to ask this as a layperson, but is it always a matter of conjecture and imagination? Are you always imprinting an imagined history? Can we really know from stones and bones, David Meltzer?
Well, we have to cross-examine our evidence. This is not a laboratory science where I can play out an experiment and then Dennis can check me in his lab at the Smithsonian.
Mm-hmm.
Each site is unique and more problematic. Each site is destroyed essentially in the process of excavating it, because we remove it from the ground, we change its context, we change the association of things. So we have to be very, very careful in the process of acquiring our data. We have to cross-examine our data. We have to essentially bring our own skeptical scientific tools to it. And, yeah, we're only dealing with scraps of bone and stone. And, in fact, one of the things that made Monteverde such a spectacular site was Tom Dillahay had absolutely wonderful preservation. They actually had pieces of mastodon meat, tent pegs,
wow.
Bits of plant material. And it's one of those sites that we all are terribly envious of.
Dennis Stanford, we've just got a minute left here. Do you think that one day humans will look back on our era in this way? Or do we leave a completely different kind of record over the very long span of time?
I think we're leaving a pretty confused record, and it'll take future archaeologists quite a while to sort out what's happened in our world today, unless, of course, they find our libraries and are able to translate the records that we have.
But 10,000 years forward, if we're so lucky to have humans around and checking, will they be able to build a much more three-dimensional, fleshed-out picture, or will what we see around us that looks so durable be reduced to dust?
A lot of it will be reduced to dust, and just a few durable things will remain, and it will be a difficult issue for future archaeologists.
David Meltzer, half a minute. Do you think they'll be able to figure us out at all?
I can't figure us out, Tom.
And we're right here, right now. Wow, it's been a great long glimpse back into the distant past, and we're very grateful to both of you for being with us to help us see it. Dennis Stanford at the National Museum of Natural History at the Smithsonian, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you, Tom.
And David Meltzer, professor of anthropology at Southern Methodist University. Look for his new book, Folsom, New Archaeological Investigations of a Classic Paleo-Indian Bison Kill. David Meltzer, thanks a lot for joining us.
It's been a pleasure, Tom. Thank you.
Listeners, you can continue the conversation, download the On Point podcast, or subscribe to our daily newsletter, all at our website, onpointradio.org. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.